This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Welcome to the Spectator Podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. On this week's episode, we'll be looking at the social media revolution which could sweep the Tories away. We're also going to be discussing next week's budget and agonising about the state of the nation with Geoffrey Archer. First up, whether it's Jeremy Corbyn, Donald Trump or the Brexiteers, successful politicians seem to have one thing in common, a command of social media. But what about Theresa May and her party? In the magazine this week, Robert Peston is concerned that the Prime Minister might be left behind if she fails to grasp the importance of the internet. He joins me now along with Jamie Bartlett, Director of the Centre for the Analysis of Social Media at Demos and a tech blogger for Coffeehouse, and Joe Todd from Momentum. So Robert, you say that the lack of internet savvy amongst the Tories is the party's greatest structural weakness. Isn't that a bit of an exaggeration given all the other problems?
Well, it is a structural weakness as opposed to many of the other weaknesses, which may not be quite so fundamental. But I didn't say it's its worst weakness, but it's certainly an important weakness because, you know, in the battle for the marginal voter, the swing voter, the battleground is undoubtedly social media, and the Tories are literally hopeless nowhere in that battle.
Why are they so hopeless? They've got lots of money. They can employ non-hopeless people. They don't have to try to do it in-house.
So part of the problem is that they haven't employed particularly smart people in this area recently. But they've got another very significant problem, which is quite a lot of social media in politics is organic, to use a better word. It's not just what the parties explicitly direct, but it's what supporters themselves do spontaneously. And the great problem for the Tories is it's quite difficult to find a young person who's prepared to stand up and say, I'm Tory and proud. You know, there are young Tories, but quite a lot of them are quite sheepish and they don't really want to be out there either in public or on social media. Whereas right now, and these things don't last forever, Labour is fantastically in vogue with younger people and Jeremy Corbyn is fantastically in vogue with younger people. And that is, you know, a problem in itself for the Tories. They haven't got enough young people. And it's a particular problem when it comes to the social media battle.
Joe, you work for Momentum. Is it actually the case that you do have a natural advantage because of the natural tendencies of young people to vote Labour or at least support left-wing causes?
I mean, it's definitely the case that you can't solve the social media problem by getting a load of bright young things in a room and, you know, coming up with some fantastic memes or whatever.
Which are you is saying often, you're not a bright young thing?
I'm a committed socialist who's working towards the next Labour government. There are a couple of bright young things in Momentum, definitely, but it's not down to them. It's down to the hundreds of thousands of people who, like, do want to share this stuff because they believe the messages that we're putting across and it resonates with them. And that's the Tories' core problem, really. Like, they can hire young, clever people who can do digital, but they need a programme and they need a vision and they don't have that.
You've worked out, though, how to harness that interest and how to target, presumably, the people who are interested in your messages.
Well, the interesting thing with us is that we don't target, because targeting on Facebook costs money, really. I mean, in the general election, we spent less than £2,000 on Facebook advertising.
Wow, that's less than individual MPs did on their campaigns.
Whilst at the same time...
But you're talking about Momentum now, as opposed to Labour.
Sorry,
because Labour, towards the end of the campaign, did spend quite heavily.
But... Oh, no, definitely. And, like, we have a different tactic because, I mean, we have a lot less money, obviously. But it does actually work for us. I mean, less than £2,000 Momentum spent, whilst at the same time, one in four UK Facebook users viewed one of our videos over the course of the campaign. And this wasn't because we were targeting specific demographics. Our strategy was as much virality as possible, like get these videos to spread to every corner of the nation. And in large part, they did.
Jamie, why do you think that the left is so much better at this than the right?
Well, it's better at the moment, but as Robert said, I mean, it is at the moment better, but it's not. I don't think it's necessarily going to be like that forever. I mean, Donald Trump is widely seen as having sort of mastered the social media game in America. And I think partly that's because it worked better for outsiders. It always has. I mean, back in 2009, 2010, the English Defence League, not exactly a left-wing movement, was essentially a Facebook group with a very small offline militant wing. They were far ahead of everybody else, including most on the left, at spotting the opportunities. And second, because it feels like a movement. You know, it feels like in the same way that Donald Trump and Jeremy Corbyn both feel like they're outsiders that are part of a bigger movement. And I think that encourages this kind of spread of organic content. I think the Tories were very good at targeting people with paid for adverts, but where Jeremy Corbyn's been much better is encouraging, in a much more decentralised way, thousands of people to create their own content and share it.
But I think it's important not to confuse two things. I mean, I'm now going to get in the predictable plug for my book, WTF, available in all good bookshops, which goes into how complicated the battle in social media has made politics in general right now, and why it's so important to try and understand what's going on. And there are two separate things going on. One is the kind of stuff we've just been talking about, which is the movements that to an extent grow up spontaneously, but then there are now very sophisticated businesses that are designing algorithms to target messages at vulnerable voters. And one of the things that I did find literally profoundly shocking about the Tories' general election campaign this year was they did not learn the lessons of, you know, the European Union referendum, despite the fact it was basically won by Tories working for Vote Leave. And, you know, what they did, which was absolutely brilliant, was they scraped data on not only names, addresses, emails, email addresses and mobile phones about people they could target, but more importantly, they scraped data about the preferences, the how vulnerable people were to being persuaded by their message. And then they directed their campaigning at the most vulnerable voters. And it worked tremendously well, because at the beginning of the campaign, the broadly Leave and Remain were neck and neck, 50-50. And all you had to do was move the dial a little bit in one direction and, you know, you would win. And they moved that dial largely through, some might say, a slightly sinister use of social media, but nonetheless a very effective use of social media. And when you get billionaires like Robert Mercer of Renaissance Technologies investing a chunk of his fortune, millions of dollars, in developing the kind of algorithms that allow hedge funds to beat the market, and he's developing similar sorts of algorithms that allow campaigners to, in a sense, beat the focus groups, as it were, and beat traditional campaigning by, as I say, acquiring absolutely the best data on how you shape messages to a particular vulnerable group, you know that the playing field in politics has been tilted and that those who have the technology are way ahead in an important arms race.
Well, I think what happened for the Conservatives was that in the last election, they thought that they could continue with the kind of targeted advertising on Facebook and Google. And they didn't realise that the game had changed fairly quickly already, and a very different type of campaigning was springing up, which was a lot more sort of grounded. And I think the risk for the Tories now is that they're going to try to artificially replicate that. They're going to look at momentum and say, well, we need to... Yeah, and I was at the Conservative, the Tory Glasto recently, and a lot of talk about, well, how do we create our own momentum? How can we, you know, how can we do this and that to make sure we build an organic movement? That's not quite how it works.
And Joe, momentum didn't actually exist in the 2015 election. No. And after that election, David Cameron declared that Twitter is not Britain. And he was saying this in a very triumphant way, because obviously he just won a surprise majority. Now, things seem to have changed since then, in that social media does seem to be much more powerful. Have they changed?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think David Cameron's actually still right in that regard. Like, Twitter isn't Britain. Twitter is...
So is it Facebook that's more important?
Yeah, it's
Facebook
Twitter,
is more, Facebook, more Britain Instagram. Than Twitter.
Yeah, Facebook definitely.
But it's all of them. I mean, you know, the thing which Labour did really brilliantly this time round was to create on Snapchat, product which basically got young people to go and look at where they could vote. And, it was very, very clever. The so-called get the vote out bit of the campaign was absolutely brilliant. It was all done on social media.
So do you think, Joe, that this means that parties don't actually need to worry about the press anymore? This has obviously been a historical disadvantage for Labour, in that there are fewer left-wing publications out there.
No, I think we absolutely need to engage with, work with and worry about the press. But, like, building our own media and building our own content which reaches voters directly is obviously possible now without masses of money. It's possible to do it in a very kind of like surgical, targeted way if you do have money. And that should obviously be, you know, like part of our digital communication strategy, definitely.
Do you think there's a sinister side to this? Do you agree with some?
It depends how you use it. I mean, like, there's a lot of talk about the Tories using dark ads during the election.
Sorry, what are they?
As far as I could tell, because like it seemed like spin to a certain extent, if I'm honest. But dark ads seemed to be adverts that were served about specific issues, but they weren't specifically branded as coming from the Conservative Party or being party political. Is that?
Yeah, I also understood them to be ones which are, they're not visible to anyone else except the person that sees them.
Yeah.
Which means that they are not really subject to any sort of regulation, which goes to your point, which you can't always tell whether they're political or not. This is a pretty major problem because the whole logic of social media is that it's more and more personalised and targeted. And as we create more data about ourselves, there is a constant arms race to understand more about each person.
I mean, I have to say that I think one of the really worrying things is that regulation is so far behind on all of this. I mean, obviously, we're all now agonising about the extent to which, you know, Russian troll farms are targeting elections and referendums, and they obviously have been. And that is that's a genuine worry about the extent
and
to which,
intervention
from, you know, malign outside, you know, forces can distort election outcomes. But let's be also clear, the point that you raise is there are limits on election spending and controls over the kind of advertising you can do, but you know, there's quite a lot that goes on in the social media sphere that is such a grey area, and the regulators just haven't got a clue what to do about it.
But I think what is also interesting on this is the other side of the dark ads, which is essentially a lot of the kind of like very public individuals coming out and backing Labour and backing Momentum, the messages we were putting out by sharing this content. Because then you associate yourself as an individual with this content. It becomes almost like a brand, which is part of your identity. That kind of campaigning is, I mean, it costs nothing because obviously it's individuals doing it in a decentralised fashion, but it's also very public. I think to a certain extent, like a good model for kind of like public discourse and how politics should be practiced. We know who's backing these messages, and you're backing that message not in kind of like a secret way by serving it at somebody and no one knowing that advert has been served, but by, you know, attaching your identity to it, posting it on Facebook and say, you know, I am Joe and I believe this.
But I mean, the other thing, just to pick up on something else we were just discussing, is the other thing which was really fascinating to me during the general election campaign was the total disconnect between traditional media and social media. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the reason I became pretty confident quite early on that Labour and Corbyn were going to do way better than quite a lot of the opinion polls and the established media were saying was because the conversations that were taking place on social media were completely different from the stuff that was on the front page of newspapers. So many people who were engaging in the election simply didn't care what was on the front page of the Daily Mail or the Daily Express or the Daily Telegraph. They just regarded that as a separate conversation for other people and not them. And it was extraordinary, in particular, how the Tories simply didn't notice that the attacks on Labour were not cutting through.
And this can really create a sense of momentum. But I mean, the idea that you're part of this movement, it's not necessarily that you're targeting every single person, but you are creating a big groundswell of support of people who feel attached to it, are willing to get out on the streets, they're willing to knock on doors. This is what Beppe Grillo did 7 or 8 years ago in Italy. He saw that you can use social media. You're not going to win an election through tweets alone, but you can use that to get people out on the streets for you, fill up all the rallies, build a sense of momentum behind the movement, and those people will go and vote.
And you can work out what people are thinking the way that the Tories didn't. So, Joe, does this mean that you had a pretty good idea of where the snap election was going much before the exit poll that shocked the rest of us?
I mean, we didn't obviously have bags of money to do our own kind of like internal polling or anything like that. And we were, you know, kind of like relatively sure that our kind of like immediate circles were probably not representative of the whole nation. I think that's fair. But then at the same time, we were obviously a lot more optimistic than everybody else. And that came through in our targeting strategy, actually. Like, you know, we targeted seats in a far more optimistic fashion than other parts of the Labour Party.
When you say targeting them on the ground as opposed to media.
Yeah, on the ground. And that is something which hasn't quite come into this conversation yet, but which is really important for us, is the intersection between digital campaigning and on-the-ground campaigning. Now, actually, it's not like it's all about the air war. It's not like that like an election is won over social media.
No, of course not.
But at the same time, we can't treat social media in a kind of like...
But it's how social media allows you to bang on the right doors. I mean, the thing that was absolutely brilliant about the Vote Leave campaign is what they discovered from social media were the houses where they knew there were people in there, that if they banged on the door, they would actually get, you know, the chances of a convert, which and it was the way they gathered data on where those susceptible voters lived.
But my argument would be it's not just targeting, it's also distributing as well. So we used a platform called My Nearest Marginal, which was like it showed where like your closest marginal constituency was, etc., etc. That was very clever in that basically it distributed a lot of the workload we would have had to do in an office out to individuals. 100,000 people used that website. It's four times a membership for Momentum over the course of the election. That kind of organising is important.
Can I make one tiny final point? Literally tiny final point. Obviously, I've written this piece saying, you know, the Tories have got a huge structural problem. Actually, there's also an enormous opportunity here, because if the next election happens with the parties more or less, you know, 40-ish percent in the polls before the election, it will be the party that actually manages to win that 2 or 3% in the middle who haven't made up their minds who will end up in 10 Downing Street. And so the extraordinary thing for the Tories is they can be so bad on social media at the moment, and yet at the moment, frankly, not very far behind Labour.
And if they lose and go into opposition, there will be a creation of a grassroots, energetic, conservative social media movement as well.
That was Robert Peston, Jamie Bartlett and Joe Todd. And Robert's book, WTF, is out in all bookshops now.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellarplan.
Next, Philip Hammond's first budget of the new Parliament will be revealed next week. So what should we expect? Nothing, says James Forsyth in his column this week, despite a growing need for a bold vision from the dispirited Tories. He joins me now, along with Torsten Bell, director of the Resolution Foundation.
So, James, have we had a worse backdrop to a budget in recent years?
No, it's very hard to think of one. And I think what scares a lot of people in the cabinet, it's the last time Philip Hammond delivered the budget. He had a very good backdrop. The Tories were massively far ahead in the polls. Everything seemed to be going swimmingly. And even with that backdrop, the budget went wrong. He tried to increase national insurance on the self-employed. There was a ferocious backlash and he was forced to back down. This time round, the backdrop is awful. And it's awful because the relations between number 10 and number 11 are pretty dire. Relations between Hammond and a substantial section of the Tory backbenches are bad. And you've got all the problems with the public finances, with the OBR expected to downgrade the productivity forecast. And he's got to find money for the DUP deal, for student loan tuition fees freeze that the Tories announced at conference, and all sorts of other things. So it's not an easy budget.
Torsten, you've seen a few budgets yourself. Do you think James is exaggerating how difficult this is? Aren't all budgets quite difficult given the subject matter?
So budgets are difficult, and I think most budgets since the financial crisis are particularly difficult, because doing economic policy in tough times is unsurprisingly harder than doing it in easy times. Now, in some ways, you might say it isn't any different to some budgets in the sense that he's likely to get worse public finance figures, but they won't be as big as some of the downgrades that George Osborne saw. George Osborne lost £50 billion in one set of forecasts. This isn't going to be as bad as that. Lots of chancellors have had to go into a budget knowing they've got to pay for reversing decisions they've just announced. Like James says, he's got to reverse the changes on national insurance for the self-employed, but Gordon Brown had 10p taxes to reverse. George Osborne had to reverse tax credit cuts before. The difference here is he's got all those kind of problems going on at once, at the same time as a big set of political and economic headaches, delivering Brexit while not looking supportive of it, and not having a majority in the House of Commons. So it's the coming together of all of those that structurally puts the Chancellor in a difficult situation.
And do you agree with James's opening lines that this is one of perhaps the government's last chance to regain the political initiative? Can you actually do that with a budget?
No, I'm not sure I agree with that. Not because, it would be a good idea to try and do that. And that's a good thing for the government to be trying to do. And that is what they need desperately. What the government is lacking is any sense of momentum. Momentum either on, with a small m, momentum either on Brexit or on having a domestic agenda. And what political leadership should be about in an era when you as a party don't have momentum is to do everything you can to regain it. Because without that, it's very hard either to do well politically or actually to change anything in the country. And ideally, that's what you're in it for. Or I don't think it's his last chance, because personally, I think we're all here for a long slog through to 2022. Political cycles come and go over that 4.5 year period, and I'm sure there'll be other chances. It's just not very sensible for a Conservative Party to kind of run through half a parliament without that sense of initiative, so they should probably get on with reclaiming it.
James, is the biggest risk actually that rather than sort of failing to regain the political initiative, Philip Hammond actually makes things a lot worse with a big mistake?
So this is the debate in the Tory high command is essentially this. Some people, and the debate actually within the Treasury among Hammond's advisers too, some people say you've got to regain the initiative, and to do that you've got to be big and bold, and if you're big and bold, if things go wrong, with minor measures, you can at least point to the big picture. Other people say the one thing you cannot afford now is a mistake, so let's keep this as small as possible. See, I think that is a flawed strategy, because when the Treasury sets out to raise relatively small amounts of money in fiddly ways, they nearly always go wrong. I think it is almost guaranteed that there will be some relatively minor measure in the budget that doesn't stand out in the Red Book as particularly significant, but it will be the equivalent of the pasty tax. It will be something that drives people crazy, and given there will be no shortage of Tory MPs prepared to offer a quote to the newspaper when they are called up and say, isn't this an outrage? He's got that problem anyway. He needs to deal with it. I also think, on Torsten's point, they've got to have some momentum. The reason that every drama turns into a crisis is because it's not clear what they're doing. And I think this budget's got to do two things. It's got to give him a bit of a domestic agenda, and he's also got to set out some vision for how he thinks Britain pays its way in the world outside of a single market and the customs union. I think one of the kind of ironies of Philip Hammond is he actually has a relatively decent view in the 10, 15 years' time of where the UK economy should be. And I think it's a vision of the UK economy about artificial intelligence, medical research and stuff. And it's actually quite well suited to a kind of post-Brexit world. But he loathes Brexit so much, he can't bring himself to articulate that.
Torsten, one of the big visions that James endorses in his column is house building. You've been writing about this as well. What do you think that Philip Hammond should be announcing?
Well, I think James is definitely right that housing stands out as the economic issue that could provide the Conservative Party with that kind of a momentum and initiative. That's because, one, the problem is very big, and you haven't got to spend much time in the United Kingdom to see what house price is doing, what has happened to home ownership, which has fallen from about 60% in 2000 to about 50% today. There's now actually less people with mortgages who own a house in Britain today. It's about 24% of households. There's more of them that own their houses outright. That's how hard it is to get a mortgage in Britain today. And even if you don't own a home, housing is a catastrophe for you because rents are so much higher than they were back in the 80s. In the 90s, the average millennial is spending 25% of their income now, or the average, on housing. So it's the right issue to be going at. It ticks the intergenerational box, it ticks the domestic agenda box, and unlike most areas of policy, it's something the state can actually do something about. They control land use, they control borrowing, they control planning. Like, these are all susceptible to action. The challenge he's got is knowing which one to pull and doing that in a way that doesn't cause him other political problems.
Because there are political problems, as you say, James, in your column with this.
Yeah, look, Theresa May is very reluctant to do proper planning reform. The Whip's office have been saying to Philip Hammond, going to go easy on this. I think this is a misreading of the political situation. I think the fear of Jeremy Corbyn is sufficiently large, and as Torsten says, the crisis has got sufficiently big that people would accept more houses. I think if you basically said to people, look, you either going to have to accept 300 more houses near you, or Jeremy Corbyn's going to get in and you're going to have nothing to pass on to your children anyway because he doesn't believe property is theft. You know, I think that argument actually works. I think the argument within the Tory party has moved quite substantially. I also think this, if you take the newspapers, the Mail and the Telegraph, that have traditionally kicked up about the Greenbelt and development, if you did this as a kind of getting Britain ready for Brexit thing, if you wrapped it up with a Brexit bow, I think you'd find that people were much more accepting of it.
Could excluding the Greenbelt from planning reform, could that scupper it, or is it not as important as some of those advocates of liberalisation of the planning laws make it out to be?
Well, I think the Greenbelt is important, and clearly you don't need to scrap the Greenbelt to make a big difference, but allowing, and actually some areas do have flexibility about how they use the Greenbelt, about moving bits of land in and out of it.
Cambridge is one of them, isn't
Cambridge
it?
Has done things around that. Manchester and others have looked at making kind of changes here and there, so it can be done with political will, but obviously that requires political will at the local level as well as at the national level. But, you know, beyond that, if we want to see large numbers of housing built, the state is going to have to actually put some money where its mouth is. There's not kind of a cost-free way of doing this. The private sector is not going to pick up house building beyond the kind of roughly 170, 180, even getting up to 200,000 homes a year we've got at the moment. And the government says it wants 300,000 built. Well, if it wants that to happen, then it's going to have to spend some money to do it, both in building affordable social housing, but also actually in getting private sector developments going.
And James, do you think that Philip Hammond could actually aim for Labour votes in the Commons on any controversial planning votes, if he has to have votes on matters, actually discounting some of the Conservative rebels and expecting Jeremy Corbyn's party to help him get house-building measures through?
I mean, it would be very hard for Labour to vote, without looking incredibly partisan, for Labour to vote against sensible planning reform. I also think that if it came to a vote, I don't think that many Tory MPs really would be prepared to do this. And I think that one of the other problems is this, is the government are approaching this the wrong way. They should start out with more than they want on the Greenbelt, and then they should offer some concessions and then get it through the Commons, rather than Hammond being negotiated down to next to nothing by Theresa May and then them coming forward with next to nothing and still facing the backlash and having nothing that they can give away.
And finally, what does Philip Hammond need to watch out for, Torsten? What mistakes do you think he could fall into? George Osborne was notorious for telling everyone about the clever traps he'd set for Labour before falling into them. What's Hammond's weakness?
Hammond's weakness in general is that he hasn't got very good politics and he hasn't got a good nose either for where the Conservative Party is or where the country is. And that means...
It's quite a big weakness.
So that's what you'd call suboptimal. And that's what did for him at the March budget, where he had a perfectly sensible proposal on self-employment, national insurance changes, but managed to do it on its own on a day with a budget where there was no other news to be had for people to look at, no other good news stories, and he managed to miss the fact that it was a breach of his own manifesto. So it wasn't the substance that did him, it was the politics and the wider messaging. So that is the same risk here. All I would say is he's obviously become significantly more risk averse since then. I mean, he spends every other day being hit around the head by the motion of the Tory press, and by elements of the parliamentary Conservative Party. So I don't think he's going to make exactly that mistake. I think the question, and the question James is really posing for him, is does he now react to that by going the other way and then doing nothing because he's so keen to avoid anything that's risky? And then that might give him micro protection against some risks, but gives him a big macro problem, which is, as James says, with government without an agenda.
I think he's got to show a vision. I think if this budget doesn't have anything in it, if when he sits down our first reaction is that it, then I think it adds to the sense that this government is in office, but why? For no particular apparent reason. I think he's got to give it a sense of direction. I also think that boldness here would be rewarded, because I think that the big criticism of him, that one of Nick Timothy's criticisms of him, is that he's really a chief secretary to the Treasury masquerading as a chancellor. You know, he's someone who's interested in kind of making sure that all the numbers on the line add up at the end of the day, but he's got no vision. The numbers at the end of the line aren't going to add up anyway, so he might as well go big.
That was James Forsyth and Torsten Bell. And James will be discussing the contents of the budget with Andrew Neil and Fraser Nelson on the 22nd of November. Just go to spectator.co.uk/events for tickets.
Hello, I'm Sam Leith, literary editor of The Spectator, and I present the weekly books podcast, at which you'll hear lively discussions from the best and most interesting critics and writers and authors out there, from Charlotte Rampling to Daniel Dennett, all the way past to Michael Morpurgo. I very much hope you'll give us a try. Just search for Spectator Books on the iTunes store.
And finally, if the scandals of the last couple of weeks feel like they could have been ripped from the pages of a gripping political novel, it makes sense to have Geoffrey Archer cast his eye over them. He's profiled by Alex Clark in the magazine this week and joins me now. So, Geoffrey, you say in your interview with The Spectator this week that you're fairly convinced Jeremy Corbyn will be our next Prime Minister. Why do you think that?
Well, I got everything wrong this year, which is a good start. I said Trump couldn't become the candidate. I then said Trump couldn't possibly become the president. I then said Remain would win. I then said the Conservatives would win by about 100 seats. So I've had a good year, Isabel. So my latest prediction that Corbyn could be Prime Minister could be wrong, but in politics, I've noticed over the years, over many, many years, that the electorate get bored with you. They like a change almost for the sake of it. And we will have been in power, if we were to survive the 5 years, we will have been in power for a long time. And they may just feel, let's give that Corbyn fellow a go. Now, those of you like yourself, embedded in politics, in the Westminster bubble, might find that hard. But if you... I mean, I'm going to Leicester tomorrow. I was in Durham last week. You listen to people outside of London. They're saying very different things.
And I suppose they said quite a different thing in the snap election. I mean, I'll join your club of being wrong about everything this year, because like you, I suspect I didn't expect Theresa May to lose seats in the 2017 election. But what did you make of her decision to call that vote in the first place?
Well, I didn't object when she made the announcement. I watched her on television, making the announcement. I thought, that's fine, she'll win by 100. She can get on with governing. And perhaps more important, the Brexit negotiations will be a lot easier because the Europeans will realise she has a strong enough mandate to do almost as she wishes. But as we know, that went wrong. I think what went badly wrong, Isabel, was the amount of time. Margaret Thatcher always thought 4 weeks, 3 days was more than enough. We gave Corbyn 7 weeks and 3 days. Now, there will have been those in the party advising her who would have said he'll make a bigger fool of himself every single day. So by the time you get to 7 weeks, 3 days, you'll probably win by 200. Truth was, exactly the opposite. He got stronger every day. He got better known every day. And a lot of people liked him more every day. And we suffered from it.
And what did you make of how Theresa May conducted herself during that campaign? You've already explained how the Tories underestimated Corbyn. Did the Tories overestimate their own leader?
That's a trickier one to answer because I wasn't in Downing Street and I don't know what the advisers were saying. But in the days of Margaret Thatcher and John Major, we foot soldiers out on the pavements were in regular touch with the Prime Minister. It was about the only time in our lives we were. We suddenly got lifted from being irrelevant nuisances to what are they saying in Durham? And I just got the feeling she wasn't getting back off the street what was happening. And that's vital. And I also was puzzled by how many senior members of the cabinet, not least the Chancellor of the Exchequer, were not being exposed to the public and telling them the good news. Why were they hidden away? That had me completely puzzled. When the four elections I was involved in, we took over the lives of the Chancellor, the Foreign Secretary, the Defence Secretary, whoever it might be, and put them into marginal seats and had them selling the good news. Whereas the election I watched, admittedly from the outside, appeared to be one person, the Prime Minister, and advisers in Downing Street who were not what I call on-the-street people. And she suffered from it.
Do you complain about the lack of exposure of her cabinet during the election campaign? But I suspect that Theresa May would rather prefer that her cabinet were less high profile at the moment, given the number of resignations and scraps between various ministers. So what do you think of how things are going for the government now?
You know, I'm not living in Downing Street or even in a ministerial office, so I don't know what's happening at the centre. My vision or my opinion, I get from people on the street. And sometimes at different levels. I was in the city today and a senior banker from Morgan Grenfell said to me, do you know, I do like the way Jeremy Corbyn doesn't raise his voice. I do like the way he's always calm and thoughtful. Well, I never thought I'd hear that from a senior banker in the city. And when I said, well, I'm among those who thinks he could be the next Prime Minister, he just nodded his agreement.
And what did you make of the fall of Michael Fallon?
Very sad. Well, I mean, now you're talking about someone I know and like very much indeed and have known for many, many years. He was an outstanding Secretary of State, respected by the armed forces, which isn't always an easy position. They're never quite sure how to treat their minister, but they did respect him. He was utterly hardworking. I mean, he was a slave to his job and was the first to admit that he thought he'd got the right job and was very happy. So at a personal level, I was very, very sorry that he went. I'm not still 100% sure I know why he went.
So it doesn't sound as though you think he should have resigned, given what was in the public domain?
Well, we were told a whole lot more would be coming out in the next few days. Well, I've yet to see it.
Do you think there's a witch hunt going on in Westminster at the moment following all the sexual harassment allegations?
I think it's getting out of proportion. I did a speech for the Daily Mail on Saturday, and the editor of You magazine got up and said, if anybody wants to cuddle Jeffrey, they can. And everybody burst out laughing. It was an all-female audience for You magazine. They all burst out laughing. And I just sat there and thought, it's very interesting, this witch hunt, as you call it, Isabel. They clearly got their own views on it and their own attitudes. And Michael Parkinson's very good article in The Telegraph last week saying, I've always been a flirt, I enjoy women's company, I shall now have to be a whole lot more careful at the age of 82. Yeah, I had some sympathy with that.
Do you feel nostalgic for your time in politics, just talking about it now? Do you ever just yearn to return?
No. I don't forget I served two remarkable people in Margaret Thatcher and John Major. Loved the four elections that I was closely involved in. One of the results wasn't altogether too happy, but three of them were pretty good. And that was the side I would have enjoyed. But I think the next chairman of the party, because clearly we're going to have a new chairman fairly soon, that's a hell of a big job. Because that person, when she chooses that person, that is the person who will prepare for the next election. That is the person who will now go into their office and work out which are the marginal seats, and there were 62 in my last election, 62 seats we had to win to remain in government. And we worked on those 62 seats. But we had an entire plan for 40 above the 60 and 40 below the 60. I mean, it was a very professional plan. And to be fair to both prime ministers, both Margaret Thatcher and John Major, once election mode turned on, frankly, putting it as politely as I can, they did as they were told because they knew all the groundwork had been done. And they stopped being Prime Minister on Thursday morning, wherever it was, and they had to go out being leader of the Conservative Party, which is a different job. And they had to rely on the people in central office and the people on the ground to make sure they won. The point of that is the appointment of the next chairman will be, it's a very important job.
What sort of message do you think the Conservatives should take into the election, whenever that may be?
That's a silly question, Isabel, because when's it going to be? Next week? 5 years' time? Tell me 1 week before the election and I'll answer that question. But overall, I would say that I like what Sajid Javid is doing with attempting to build 300,000 houses a year. That's incredibly brave. That's a big figure. He's a doer, that one. He likes getting on with things. So that's good. But we've got to appeal to people and make them believe we give a damn about them. What Corbyn has done brilliantly is he makes people feel he gives a damn. And frankly, Isabel, there, whatever you want to call it, caption, motto, message, for the many, not the few, was among the best political messages I have seen in 50 years.
That was Geoffrey Archer. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows, including Holy Smoke, our religion podcast, hosted by Damien Thompson and Christina Adoni. And if you enjoy the podcasts, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed on this podcast, as well as great pieces by Rod Little, Rachel Johnson and Julie Birchall. And we have a special offer for podcast listeners. 12 issues for £12 and a limited edition Spectator moleskin notebook if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/pod offer. Thanks for listening and do join us again next week.